Hello, can you all hear me? Good. Well, welcome. Before we start, can I just ask you to turn off any mobile phones and silence them? You don't want to be the one person who gets caught out with their mobile phone ringing. So welcome. My name is Roham Alvandi. I'm an associate professor of international history here at the LSE. I'm delighted to welcome you to the first annual Ghulam Reza Nikpay annual lecture in Iranian history. So this is something of a historical event. Many of you might not be aware, but LSE actually has a quite a proud and long history of involvement with Iran and of Iranian alumni here at the LSE. So particularly in the pre-revolutionary period, in the Pahlavi period, Iranian alumni of the LSE have sat at the cabinet table in Tehran. They have led the central bank in Iran. They have served as Iran's ambassadors throughout the world. They are some of the most well-known Iranian intellectuals and writers. Names like Farhang Mehr, Mehdi Samii, Fakhreddin Shadman, Hamid Enayat, Eprim Eshaq, Shirin Tahmaseb Hunter, who I'm particularly proud of. She was the first woman to ever serve in the Iranian diplomatic service. We have this very proud history that I don't think many people are really very well aware of. And so part of the reason for doing this event is to kind of bring that history to life again. The LSE was also, as many of you know, a hotbed of student radicalism in the 1960s and 1970s. So it wasn't just sort of Iranian technocrats that we were producing. We were also producing opponents of the Pahlavi state. The Iranian prime minister of the day, Amir Abbas Hoveida, he described the opponents of the Shah as, quote, little crybaby communists trained at the London School of Economics. So they're also part of our history and part of the legacy of Iran here at the LSE. And given that I'm a historian, I also want to particularly mention Feridun Adamiyat, who's probably one of Iran's best known historians, particularly of the modern era, who did his PhD here at the LSE in 1949 on the subject of the diplomatic relations of Persia with Britain, Turkey, and Russia, 1815 to 1830, which is very apropos of our lecture today. In more recent years, some of you will remember the late Professor Fred Halliday, who worked on Iran and taught a whole generation of students about Iran here at the LSE. This is a tradition I think we should be very proud of, and I think it's our responsibility to keep it alive and carry it forward, which is why we've created this annual lecture. And I'm particularly proud that this lecture honors the memory of one of our most distinguished Iranian alumni, Dr. Ghulam Reza Nikpay. He's a name that will be well known to most Iranians. He came to the LSE in 1951 at the tender age of 21 There's a very nice photo of him in his LSE student file, sort of these old paper applications where you would staple your photograph, you know, to the application. And he had completed his undergraduate degree at the University of Tehran in political science. And he came to London wanting to study international relations, and I think wanting to do a PhD, really. But the faculty here were not quite convinced at first, and they forced him to first enroll as an MSc student. And he plugged away and, you know, convinced these LSE lecturers that he had the stuff to be able to do a PhD. One of his tutors was Martin White, who, a name for any of you who've studied international relations, will be well known, one of the major figures of the English School of International Relations. And I read Martin White's comments on the young Nick Pei's first term at LSE, and he wrote, "Extremely hardworking, earnest and serious, so much so that he needs to be encouraged in the cultivation of leisure and in reading off his subject. Still diffident and backward in taking part in discussions where he has much to contribute. Very young, and I think very promising, a man of great integrity and purpose." And I thought that was quite interesting that, you know, that Martin White saw that in Nick Pei at the age of 21. And of course, he was right. The young Ghulam Reza managed to impress the Committee on Postgraduate Studies. He was allowed to progress to his PhD, which he wrote on the subject of the political aspects of foreign oil interests in Iran down to 1947. And it's a logical subject to have chosen. You know, if you were in London in 1951 with the Anglo-Persian oil crisis in full swing and Mossadegh's nationalization of Iranian oil and the Attlee government and then the Churchill government's attempts to defy Iran, you can imagine that a young Iranian student interested in politics and history would choose that as the subject of their their dissertation. He completed his dissertation in 1956, and he went on to a very distinguished career in public service in Iran. He served as Minister of Housing from 1966 to 1969 in the Hoveyda cabinet, and he's remembered for his role in the reconstruction of Khorasan after the devastating earthquake there in 1968. But he's best known, of course, as the mayor of Tehran between 1969 and 1977. And that was a period, really, when Tehran was completely transformed. In fact, the Tehran that we know today really was created in that decade during Nick Pei's tenure. There were so many civic projects in that period, I wouldn't be able to even begin to list them all, but everything from construction of whole new neighborhoods of Tehran, highways, parks, a recycling scheme for the city, facilities for car parking, you know, the number of automobiles in Tehran in that decade exploded, you know. Facilities for children with disabilities, and just many, many, many more initiatives, essentially prepared Tehran in that period to be the huge metropolis that it is today. And if those reforms hadn't taken place, the city would never have been able to cope with the population explosion that happened in the 1970s. Dr. Nick Pei returned to the LSE while he was mayor in 1976. I found in the archives a note about the dinner that Lord Dahrendorf, our director at the time, hosted for him and Mrs. Nick Pei. And I like to think it must have been a very proud moment for him and also for his teachers who were there, at that dinner. Tragically, I mean, who would have known that just 3 years later, with the Iranian Revolution in 1979, Dr. Nikpay, like many others who'd served Iran in the Pahlavi period, lost his life to the revolutionary terror that gripped Iran. But I'm happy to say that he is remembered here at LSE, and he's honored here at LSE. We're delighted that this annual lecture could be established in his memory. And we're even more privileged, I dare say, to have as our first speaker, our inaugural speaker, Professor Hushang Shahabi, who's not only a dear friend, but a teacher of mine. And I'm going to embarrass him now, because I can. He is, and I say this without any exaggeration, he is the greatest living historian of modern Iran. He has just retired from a very long-standing career at Boston University, where he was professor of history and international relations. So he is emeritus there, but Hushang is untiring. He's taken up a position as honorary professor at the University of St. Andrews. And it's impossible for me to convey to you the range of his work. He began as a political scientist, completing his PhD at Yale under the supervision of the great Juan Linz. And his early work was very much focused on the political history of Iran, particularly the time of the revolution, the 1979 revolution. But he's also written on the constitutional revolution and also on the post-revolutionary Islamic Republic. And that would have probably been enough for most academic careers. But Hushang decided to make himself essentially the person who invented cultural history in Iranian studies. And he is now, I think, best known as a historian of Iranian culture in all of its aspects. He has written on everything from sports to food to dress to music. He's the only scholar of Iran that I know of who has published in the journal Gastronomica, where he wrote an article on how caviar became halal after the 1979 revolution. So that gives you just a hint of what you can expect. So I'm very honored and humbled that he accepted our invitation, and we're very grateful to have him here. The title of his lecture is Iran's Struggle for Sovereignty, 1828 to 1928. So please join me in welcoming Professor Shahabi to the LSE.
Thank you very much, Professor Alvandi, dearest Roham. It's a great pleasure to be here. I was actually admitted to the LSE to be an undergraduate. I just remembered that, totally forgotten. But I prefer to go to Sciences Po instead. So my loss. Ghulam Reza Nikpay was actually mayor of Tehran during the 4 years that I lived in Iran from high school, the last 4 years of high school. And I was reminded of him on two occasions recently. Almost exactly a year ago, I was in Seoul in South Korea, and I found out that members of the Iranian community in Seoul had staged a meeting in support of the Zan Zindagi Azadi movement in Seoul's Tehran Street. I didn't know Seoul had a Tehran Street. I knew Tehran had a Seoul Street, but I didn't know that Seoul had a Tehran Street. And a quick search in the internet revealed that the two streets owed their name to a visit that Mayor Nikpay had paid to Korea in June 1977. And then just a few weeks ago, I learned that Tehran's beautiful Qeytariyeh Park also owes its existence to Nikpay. It seems that the garden belonged to relatives of his who wanted to parcel out the land and sell the plot to developers, the different plots to developers. But he, as mayor, steadfastly refused to give the necessary permission, accepting the wrath of his relatives, and then donated his own share of the green space, and the result is what is arguably Tehran's most beautiful park today, Parc-e Qeytariyeh. So I'm very pleased and honored to inaugurate a lecture series graced by his name. My talk today, Iran's Struggle for Sovereignty 1828-1928, focuses on the international relations of Iran in what is known as the Age of Empire. The decades in which European powers brought most of Africa and Asia under their control. Of the roughly 200 countries in the world today, only six managed to remain independent and not to be incorporated into European empires. These six are China, Japan, Thailand, Turkey, Iran, and Ethiopia. These countries had to pay a high price for their continued existence, namely limitations on their sovereignty imposed by European powers. These limitations were embodied in what has come to be known as unequal treaties. Why unequal? Because contrary to most treaties, which are premised on reciprocal rights and obligations between the parties, these treaties were not. Most importantly, and this will be the focus of my presentation, the citizens of European powers had extraterritorial rights, which means that they were exempted from local jurisdiction. This arrangement, which has had a long history in the Ottoman Empire, was known as capitulations. And it allowed Europeans to be tried in special courts dominated by the consuls of the European powers, hence the term consular jurisdiction. In the case of Iran, capitulations began in 1828 and ended in 1928. I'm currently living in Paris, and so I will return to my roots and divide my talk into three parts, as I was taught to do 50 years ago when I was an undergraduate in France. First, I will discuss the circumstances of the imposition of an unequal status on Persia. After that, I will look at how Iranian leaders, diplomats, and intellectuals perceived this inequality and what they tried to do about it. And finally, I will explain how Iranians managed to rid themselves of these capitulations. So, what are capitulations? Before the 19th century, various Persian rulers had signed treaties with European powers on a more or less equal footing. Some of these treaties included provisions for consular jurisdiction, but this arrangement was reciprocal. For instance, a treaty signed in 1708 between the last effective ruler of the Safavid dynasty, Shah Sultan Hussein, and France provided for consular jurisdiction for French subjects in Persia, but also granted the same privileges to a Persian consul in Marseille. Nothing came of this treaty, however, since Iran was soon plunged into the turmoil of the 18th century. At the end of the 18th century, the Qajars reestablished the political unity of the Iranian plateau, and that brought them into conflict with the expanding Russian Empire and the Caucasus. As a result of losing the ensuing wars, Iran was forced to sign an onerous treaty with Russia in 1828 that granted all sorts of non-reciprocal privileges to Russian subjects in Iran. The name of the village in which this treaty was signed, Turkmenchay, became a byword for Iran's second-class status in international society. In 1889, when Etemad Saltaneh, Nasiruddin Shah's Minister of Publications, passed through the village and saw the ruins of the house in which the treaty had been signed, he noted in his diary, quote, "The basis of all of Iran's misfortunes were laid in this house." It was in this treaty that Russia received capitulatory rights similar to those enjoyed by European powers in the Ottoman Empire. Article 7 established that, quote, all suits and litigations between Russian subjects will be subject exclusively to the examination and decision of the Russian mission or consuls in conformity with the laws and customs of the Russian Empire. As for differences in suits between Russians and Persians, they will, quote, be brought before the governor and will be examined and judged only in the presence of the dragoman of the mission or the consulate. If a Russian was found guilty in a criminal case, he would be turned over to the Russian mission, which would return him to Russia to be judged by Russian laws. What made this derogation to Persian jurisdiction even more irksome was that, as per Article 6, quote, Persian subjects forming part of the suit of the minister or chargé d'affaires or consuls will enjoy the same protection on an equality with Russian subjects. In other words, Persian employees of the Russians would also have extraterritorial rights. After Russia, the next country to acquire capitulatory rights in Persia was Great Britain. Iran was now embroiled in Britain's imperialism of free trade, as it has been called, and the British pressured the Persian ruler to issue edicts guaranteeing the proper treatment of British subjects, their servants, and their dependents. The Iranian government resisted this pressure for a while, but in 1841, the two states concluded a commercial treaty that gave the British extraterritorial rights based on the most favored nation principle. What the Russians had, the British wanted as well. Now, it's interesting to note, and this is less known, that extraterritorial arrangements also existed between Iran and the Ottoman Empire, except that they were reciprocal. These were the results of two treaties signed between the two sides in 1823 and 1847. And this arrangement, this reciprocal arrangement between the Ottomans and Persians will have a certain effect on the abolition of the capitulations in Tehran, in Iran, as we shall see. Now, the provisions of the commercial treaties with Russia and Britain set the stage for similar treaties of friendship and commerce with other countries. Signing these treaties was regarded by many officials in Iran as a necessary concession in order to salvage the independence of the country. Moreover, the decentralized nature of the Iranian legal system made accommodating capitulatory rights relatively easier, because different groups in Iran had different sets of rules and regulations to govern them. Tribes, peasants, religious minorities, etc. And so, in this context of legal pluralism, just one more group was added, namely foreigners. Ultimately, these capitulations secured Iran's sovereignty, because by signing them, even though they were unequal, the capitulatory powers acknowledged that the weaker party, namely Iran, was in fact not a colony. What made the consular jurisdiction granted to the major powers increasingly problematic was that, while in principle these arrangements were reserved for foreign subjects, Article 6 of the Turkmenchay Commercial Treaty was interpreted ever more broadly by Russia and subsequently other capitulatory powers as time went by. More and more Persian subjects came to enjoy European protege status, thus diminishing the authority of the Iranian government over its own subjects. As I said, Qajar Iran was characterized by legal pluralism. There was no centralized judiciary, and a number of different actors were involved in the administration of justice. Clerics, state officials, landowners, tribal leaders. Most disputes were resolved informally by arbitration within the family or guilds, in which case, of course, local connections helped. People know each other, so the arbitrators are more likely to find in favor of somebody they know. Moreover, by contemporary European standards, the punishment for severe crimes could be quite brutal. To gain a confession, torture could be used. And convicted criminals were subject to harsh measures. Another problem was that there was no systematic registration for land and deeds. Documents could be tampered with, even forged, with impunity. Property rights were thus insecure, and enforcing contracts and selling debts were difficult. Merchants conducted long-term, long-distance transactions through informal networks, and unmet claims to payments were dealt with through arbitration. No wonder foreign merchants felt uneasy about this system, because they didn't have the same connections in society. And so we have lots of cases where a British merchant, for instance, gets into a dispute and has to wait for years until he can get some of the money he has invested back. And I should also add that many Iranians felt that this legal system was failing them, and they were more likely to have a favorable outcome in a suit if a foreign consul was present. And this was precisely why so many wanted to gain protege status. So what was done about the situation? What could you do about this? The Iranian response was twofold. Domestically, calls for reform grew, and on the international scene, the Iranian government tried to assert its presence as a sovereign power. The two are, of course, closely related, as many Iranian reformers were also diplomats who had lived abroad and had first-hand knowledge of the gap that separated Iran from the West in terms of development, and separated Iran even from the Ottoman Empire, which was more developed than Iran. Ottoman reforms were of particular importance to Iranians because they were enacted in a fellow Muslim state, and therefore the suspicion against them was less important than the suspicion one might feel for reforms that were imitating France or England. By the mid-19th century, the subordinate status of Iran led some leading statesmen to look for ways to strengthen the state. As in Russia and the Russian Empire before, the nexus between domestic political reform and the search for parity with European empires was very close. Persia's first reformist prime minister, Mirza Tahir Khan Amirkabir, aimed to centralize the state by creating stronger institutions, and some of his initiatives actually affected foreign residents. But after only 3 years in office, Amirkabir fell from power, was executed, and his reforms petered out. For those who followed in his footsteps, structural reforms were needed. They thought that, you know, it's not enough for the state to behave in a better way, structural reform is needed. And the most important aspect was the establishment of the rule of law. This was a bold notion, for the very idea of a rationalized in the sense of uniform and cohesive legal system encompassing all the population was alien to the country. At the same time, it was a sine qua non for achieving parity in international relations. The Iranian defeat in the 1857 war with Britain strengthened the feeling in Iran that, and I'm here quoting Anne Lambton, quote, "The main reason for the superior power of Western European nations was their form of government. And for the first time, thought began to be given not merely to the reform of the abuses of the system, but to the reform of the actual system of government." Soon thereafter, Malkam Khan, a Persian diplomat serving in Paris, published a treatise on political administrative reform. Inspired by the Ottoman precedent, where Kanun had acquired the sense of positive law, he introduced new arguments regarding the word qanun in Persian into the Persian language. Inspired by Malkam Khan, another Persian diplomat, Mirza Yusuf Khan Mostashar-e-Doleh, in 1871 completed a book in Paris that he titled Yek Kalame, One Word, the one word being law. So we see the influence of diplomats on the development of reformism in Iran. One, if not the most significant obstacle in the introduction of a unified legal system was the requirement that followers of all religions be equal before the law. A principle that the reformers took for granted, even though they acknowledged that Europeans were not respecting it in their colonial empires, the French in Algeria, for instance. But the equality of citizens squarely contradicts the Sharia. So what to do? In 1867-68, Yusuf Khan, by now chargé d'affaires in Paris, and his colleagues in St. Petersburg and London sent a joint letter to the Persian government in which they argued that, quote, the task whose accomplishment is needed above all else is the establishment of law. Until such time as the legislative and executive powers are separated, it will be impossible for the state and the nation to strengthen the army, extend development, and, this is interesting, secure a good name among foreign states. The three ambassadors, also urged an end to cruel punishments, for these are hated by the people and gave the country a bad name. In other words, for these reformers, Iran could attain parity only if it earned the respect of the main powers, and to gain that respect, it had to reform. Beginning in 1870, an opportunity arose to put these reforms into practice. In that year, Mirza Hossein Khan Mujibud-Dowleh was named Minister of Justice. This man had been Iranian ambassador in Constantinople for 12 years, during which time he had met Malcolm Khan, and also developed a personal relationship with statesmen of the Second Tanzimat era. Inspired by the Ottoman reforms, he embarked on an ambitious plan to reorganize Iran's judicial system. When he was promoted to the position of prime minister, he recalled Yusuf Khan from Paris and made him Minister of Justice. So reformists are now in charge. For a brief period, it seemed as though reform had finally come to Iran. The administration of justice was improved, regulations were drawn up, cruel punishments were prescribed, and even a draft for a constitution was circulated. But it's one thing to have regulations, it's another one to implement them. When the prime minister granted a wide-ranging concession to Baron de Reuter to raise revenues, the move aroused much opposition, prompting the Shah to dismiss him, and after that, once again, the reforms petered out. Oddly enough, the reformers rarely, if ever, mentioned the issue of extraterritoriality as a motivation for their projects. What mattered was to strengthen the state, the Iranian state, by establishing the rule of law. This would allow Iran to enter the community of nations as an equal. Japan, after the Meiji Restoration, was proof that this could be done. Since European powers renounced their capitulatory rights in Japan in the 1890s, after Japan had created a modern legal system. Throughout the remaining years of Iran's ancien regime, clerics opposed any reforms that entailed equal rights for non-Muslims, both native and foreign. In 1891, Malcolm Khan lamented, "It is true that the Japanese have copied Europe. There is no such obstacle there as in our case, for their religion is not so strong. But we are prevented from following their example." It would only be after the Constitutional Revolution of 1906 that secular modernists would find the courage to challenge conservatives on this issue. The Revolution of 1906, as everybody knows, was carried forward by an alliance whose members were united in their desire to put an end to royal despotism. The ruler, Muzaffar ad-Din Shah, yielded, signing the constitution on his deathbed in late 1906, but his successor was not inclined to part with his powers, and exploited fissures within the constitutional movement to his advantage in order to thwart it. Again, the most contentious issue was the equality of rights of all citizens. Many modernists were Freemasons, steeped in the tradition of liberté, égalité, fraternité, and advocated for the legal equality of all citizens. The leader of the clerical conservatives, Sheikh Fazl Honoré, vehemently argued against it. And to poke fun at the very idea that citizens could have the same rights, he pointed out that Islamic law contained no less than 17 types of inequality between people. I name them for you. According to Nouri, the Sharia differentiated between adult and immature, sane and insane, healthy and ill, free agent and desperate, willing and compelled, a person and their agent or guardian, freeborn or slave, father and son, husband and wife, rich and poor, learned and ignorant, doubtful and certain, imitator and source of emulation, descendant of the prophet and commoner, Muslim and infidel, tributary infidel and hostile infidel, kofare zemmi and kofare harbi. And finally, between an apostate who had originally been an infidel and then converted to Islam, and an apostate who had been a Muslim from the beginning. Murtad de milli and murtad de fitri. To me, he is really the most articulate theoretician of inequality that one can imagine. A civil war ensued, the conservatives lost, the Shah had to go to Russia, and Nouri was hanged. In the aftermath of the revolution and civil war, the authority of the central government crumbled in many parts of the country, and the resulting lawlessness provided Russia and Britain with more and more pretexts to meddle in Iran's affairs. So much for the empty half of the glass, thwarted reform. And now for the full half of the glass, namely Iran's attempts to assert itself on the international sphere. Because Iran did develop a considerable diplomatic activity in the 19th century, trying to make the best out of an unfavorable situation. And much of this diplomatic activity was designed to assert the country as a sovereign nation on the world stage. In 1809, Fath Ali Shah, for the first time, charged an official with the supervision of foreign relations. But it was only in 1824 that the first titular Ministry of Foreign Affairs was appointed. As a measure of stability returned to Iran in the first half of the 19th century under Fath Ali Shah and then Muhammad Shah, state building resumed. But chronic financial problems prevented the creation of stable institutions. Since the beginning of state building coincided with the wars against Russia, it is not astonishing that of all the state institutions, the most fully developed was actually the foreign ministry, because that was the most busy. That had the most urgent tasks to fulfill. However, for decades, it consisted of little more than a few officials. And by the same token, diplomatic contacts were initially not institutionalized and were conducted by individual envoys who would spend some time in Europe and then return to Iran without being replaced immediately. In 1830, the British announced a plan to establish a new trade route between India and the Emirate of Bukhara and to use Afghanistan, the Ottoman Empire, and Iran as buffer states to block Russian expansion towards India. And this started what would later be known as the Great Game, for which Iran would henceforth be one of the playing fields. As a buffer state, Iran's continued independence was ensured, allowing it to develop a presence on the international diplomatic scene. A little bit about that. Qajar Iran's first envoys were chosen from highly literate officials with some experience of the outside world. they generally made good impressions. About Iran's first emissary to France, Talleyrand, wrote that, quote, his spirit, his knowledge, rendered him worthy of representing the most spiritual nation in Asia. This man was succeeded by Askarkhan Afshar, about whom Napoleon's valet wrote, his polite and easy manners, especially with regard to ladies, had something resembling French gallantry. Even then, the Iranians were the French of the Middle East. He had a very gentle character, full of kindness and consideration for all people who went to see him, giving the ladies rose oil, the men tobacco, perfumes, and pipes. Askar Khan made a greater impression in Paris than the Turkish ambassador. He was more generous, more gallant. He paid court to the women more cleverly and more easily adapted himself to French customs and habits. Relations with France having soured, Iran sent a delegation to London in 1809. And this delegation was headed by Mirza Abul Hasan Shirazi, a notable whose family had had dealings with the East India Company. He had therefore spent some time in India and gotten to know some English people. He too charmed his hosts. According to an Irish peer who met him, quote, his manners are truly captivating, graceful, and as engaging as can be conveyed. He became the talk of town, was invited to parties, attended opera and theater performances, and was the subject of many newspaper articles. He even mastered English humor. When asked if it was true that he worshipped the sun in Persia, you know, Persians being sun worshippers, as we all know, he quipped, no, not in Persia, but I should adore it in England if I ever happen to see it. In 1824, he became the first official to bear the title of foreign minister. Both Askar Khan Afshar in Paris and Mirza Abul Hasan Khan in Shiraz, in London, tried their best to create a favorable image for Persia in Europe. They mixed freely in society, visited museums and factories, and tried to learn about European culture. They were received with pomp and circumstance, sometimes beyond what European ambassadors received. And they tried to integrate into European social networks. Both, for instance, became Freemasons, perhaps in the hope that fraternal ties would bridge religious divides, and that the equality of status reigning in the lodge would, through their endeavor, end up extending to relations between states. By the second half of the 19th century, Iran gradually had a core of competent diplomats to represent it abroad. And under Nasser al-Din Shah, permanent missions were established in a few countries, the major countries. At the same time, consulates, many of them honorary, were established around the world. In Tehran, the foreign ministry was expanded and its organization rationalized. In 1880, a French-educated diplomat, Mirza Mehdi Khan Momtahedoddoleh, took the initiative to prepare a Persian book on international law. In 1899, a school of political science was established in Tehran to train professional diplomats. And an archive for the foreign ministry was established in 1900. By the first decade of the 20th century, a German diplomat observed that, quote, a young generation of upper-class Persians who, thanks to their studies in France and Switzerland, speak fluent French, had appeared, but that their numbers were small. Still, Iran's continued sovereignty meant that the official language of the country was Persian. The diplomat observed that if one sends a communication to a Persian authority in a European language, it will be likely to be returned with a request to use Persian. So even linguistically, the government tried to assert its independence. There were other initiatives that the state took. One very important one was a state visit of the Qajar Shahs to Europe. From 1873 onwards, Qajar Shahs visited European countries. They always insisted on being treated as equals by the European monarchs that they met, the idea being that if the monarchs are equals, the countries will be equals. At the same time, they maintained they were not blind imitators of European customs. They retained certain customs. For instance, as we know, in terms of headgear, European etiquette and Eastern etiquette is different, because in Europe you take off your head when you're indoors. In Persia and the rest of the Middle East, you did not. For instance, Nasiruddin Shah and Muzaffar Shah always kept their hat on, even when shaking hands with Queen Victoria. So this was very much a breach of English etiquette, and yet they had the pride to be themselves, while also being respectful to Queen Victoria, obviously. Connected to that is Iran's participation in world's fairs. At many of the world's fairs that of the 1870s all the way to the 20th century, Iran had a pavilion. Usually a small but elaborate pavilion. One of these pavilions was actually supervised by Nasiruddin Shah himself. So when you have this international exhibition with pavilions by Russia, the United States, Brazil, Japan, and so on, Iran became one member of the family of nations by having its own pavilion with events. And sometimes the two coincided, because a number of shahs used world's fairs as a pretext to travel. And then in these world's fairs, they would meet other European kings and emperors, again, on an equal footing. Another very important assertion of sovereignty was the establishment of a modern postal system. Until then, Russia, Britain, and a few other powers had maintained courier services that conveyed mail to their respective domains and from there to the rest of the world. But in 1874, an Austrian postmaster was hired to set up a postal administration patterned on those of Europe. In 1876, the first stamps were printed for Iran in Vienna with a portrait of Nasiruddin Shah. And in 1877, Iran joined the Universal Postal Union, 2 years after the Ottoman Empire, but in the same year as Japan. Inside Iran, the state now had authority over its postal matters. And on the international scene, Persian stamps were now accepted everywhere and carried the portrait of the sovereign to the four corners of the world. And the sovereign, of course, symbolized sovereignty. Later in the century, Persia began participating in international conferences. It was present at the Brussels Anti-Slavery Conference of 1889-1890, at the Hague Conferences of 1899 and 1907, and at various Red Cross conferences, where, and this is really quite remarkable, the Iranian diplomats, the Iranian delegates, managed to extract permission to have the only country-specific emblem that organization ever accepted, namely the red lion and sun. Iran was the only country which had its own specific emblem in the Red Cross system. It is something of a paradox that as Iran's global presence increased, the country's position in international affairs weakened. As European imperialism entered a new, more intrusive phase, that of peaceful penetration, a series of bad harvests and subsequent famines impoverished the treasury, making it more vulnerable. To remedy this financial situation, a series of concessions were granted, mostly to British and Russian subjects, but occasionally to businessmen from other countries. This created the perception in the country that the country was losing its independence. Britain and Russia came to interfere in Iranian affairs even more, and gradually a Russian sphere of influence in the north and a British one in the south took shape. Nasiruddin Shah bitterly complained that, quote, should I wish to go out for an excursion or a shooting expedition in the north, east, and west of my country, I must consult the Russians. And should I intend to go south, I must consult the British. Iranian diplomats, however, did not give up. In the early 20th century, they suddenly discovered Latin America. The Iranian ambassador to Washington, Prince Esaq Mohammadoulloh, went on a grand tour and established diplomatic and treaty relations with Mexico, Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile. While this burst of diplomatic activity gave Iran greater visibility around the world, at a time when its sovereignty was more and more under threat, I should confess that this was not motivated by status consciousness alone. Nasruddin Shah's successor, Muzaffardin Shah, had in the course of his three European trips developed friendly relations with the King of the Belgians, Leopold II. Leopold II was very business savvy, and he had granted a businessman from Antwerp, who was also a diamond merchant, concessions in the Congo, the center of Africa that he ruled. The man was Louis Kutermans, and arranged for him to obtain concessions from the Germans in Southwest Africa, what we now call Namibia. Kutermans, Leopold's agent, in other words, was named Persian consul in Antwerp. Iran didn't really need a consul in Antwerp because there was an ambassador in Brussels, and Antwerp is only very close to Brussels, but there was a reason for that. It was Kutermans who arranged with Mohammad Dole to have Belgian and German businessmen appointed as honorary consuls of Iran in Latin American capitals. These honorary consuls then used the diplomatic pouch for their own commercial transactions with Kutermans, presumably giving the Iranians and perhaps even King Leopold a cut. This sudden turn to the world beyond Europe and the United States came actually close to being a case of terminal lucidity, for soon Iran barely escaped losing its sovereignty. The constitutionalists had hoped that by abolishing absolutism and establishing a state of law, Iran would be able to consolidate its independence, but this didn't happen. As part of the Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907, Britain and Russia divided into Iran into zones of influence, with Russia gaining the lion's share in the north and Britain getting a smaller share in the southeast, adjacent to British India. In 1911, Germany recognized Russia's, quote, special interests in Persia. Although the convention affirmed Iran's continued independence, Russia and Britain consolidated control over the respective zones after 1907. The discovery of oil in 1908 in southwestern Iran led the British to extend their influence beyond their official zone of influence, which was in the southeast. The Russians had devised a policy of comprehensive penetration of Persia in the 1890s. They invested 21 million rubles in the construction of strategic roads in northern Iran. And pretexting post-revolutionary instability, Russian forces occupied large parts of Iran, of northern Iran, beginning in 1909. The Russian loan and discount bank financed economic activities for Russians who bought land in Iran. Russian authorities collected taxes and actually settled farmers in northeastern Iran. There was a plan to turn Gorgan into an area populated by Russian peasants. When the government of Iran appointed an American, W. Morgan Shuster, Treasurer General in 1911 to put Iran's finances on a sounder footing, the Russians, supported by the British, found a pretext to issue an ultimatum to the government, asking the government to recall Shuster. The exordial motto Shuster chose for his account of his doomed mission seemed apt. A little verse: time with whose passage certain pains abate, but sharpens those of Persia's unjust fate. Now, given the extent of Anglo-Russian meddling in Iran's affairs, public opinion in Iran was pro-German when the Great War broke out. Iran declared its neutrality, but given the Russian occupation of northern Iran, Ottoman troops soon entered the country and gave battle to the Russians. One of the results of these battles fought on Iranian soil by outside powers was an event that has not received the scholarly attention that it deserves, and that is the genocide of Assyrians in Iran. Assyrians, Christians, were about one third of the population in the area between Lake Urmia and the Ottoman border. And they were caught up in the same genocide that decimated the Armenians of the Ottoman Empire. The genocide was not perpetrated by Iranians, but nonetheless, Iran lost much of its Christian population. As if that were not enough, the influenza pandemic that hit Iran during the same period resulted in a very significant rate of mortality. Throughout the war, political factions in Tehran had been bickering, and short, often ineffectual cabinets followed each other until a degree of stability was achieved in August 1918 with the appointment of Hassan Vesuroghdole as prime minister, who would go on to serve uninterruptedly for 2 years until 1920. When Vesuroghdole took office, the central government had lost control over many peripheral areas. And as the Ottoman Empire was being dismembered by the British and the French, many in Iran feared for the continued sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iran. That fear was not unfounded, because it is a fact that in December 1918, the British government did indeed seriously contemplate the possibility of turning Iran into a mandate to be given to a pro-British state. So I now come to the final section of the talk, the end of capitulations. How did Iran get all out of all of this? While the Great War caused Iran's great hardship, as we saw, it also provided openings for ending the capitulatory regime. In September 1914, the Ottoman government unilaterally repudiated all capitulations. This did not mean much in practice, since soon the Ottomans were embroiled in the war, and they were fighting against Britain and France, who, you know, couldn't care less whether the Ottomans had unilaterally abrogated the capitulations or not. And the capitulations in Turkey were abolished only in the Treaty of Lausanne, which was signed exactly 100 years ago in 1823. But this repudiation by the Ottomans provided an opening for Iran, because if Iranians in the Ottoman Empire lost their privileges, then Ottoman subjects in Iran could also lose their privileges on the basis of reciprocity. And the Iranian government lost no time saying that, okay, let's end the capitulations, hoping that this precedent of abolishing the Ottoman capitulations would be used for ending non-reciprocal arrangements with the other powers. The Ottoman move was discussed widely in the Iranian press in 1914, and the young lawyer who had just returned from Switzerland and who would play a major role in Iranian politics a few decades later, i.e. Mohammad Mossadegh, published a little book called Capitulation va Iran, Capitulation and Iran, in which he argued that legal reform was the only way for Iran to gain its sovereignty. He called on the clerics to relent on minor details of divine law based on the principle of expedience and changed circumstances, maslahat, in order to attain a more important goal, namely Iran's full sovereignty. If it turned out, he wrote, that the new laws were incompatible with Islamic law, the national interest and the survival of Islam demanded that the creed, Usul-e-Din, not be sacrificed for upholding laws and rituals, Furu-e-Din. He likened Iran to an ill Muslim person, to an ill Muslim person for whom the only medicine is wine. The second opening came in late 1917, when the Bolsheviks seized power in Russia. Lenin had advocated an alliance between the communists in Russia and colonized and semi-colonized nations. Semi-colonized is a term that Lenin coined for countries like Iran, Thailand, China, etc. Why this alliance? In order to weaken European imperialism and thereby capitalism. He had this notion that capitalism, contrary to Marx's predictions, had survived in Europe only because the Europeans were exploiting the rest of the world, and if that exploitation stopped, capitalism would break down in Europe as well. On that basis, the new authorities in Russia repudiated all of Russia's unequal treaties, including the ones with Iran. The trouble was that Tsarist troops still occupied Iran, and that the government of Iran did not recognize the new regime in Moscow. They still had relations with the White Russians. The Bolshevik representatives' protestations of friendship fell on deaf ears in the Iranian foreign ministry. On July 30th, 1918, Prime Minister Samson Mousaltaneh declared the capitulations abolished in light of new developments in international relations. He wrote, this is the note he sends to the various embassies, considering that all the treaties and concessions of Russia were taken by force, that the world's great powers have throughout the war affirmed weak nations' right to economic and political independence, and that the new government in Russia has declared that it will renounce its privileges, the government declared the abolition of all capitulations. The British were not amused, and let it be known that the British government would consider this an act of war. Whereupon the Iranian government didn't say anything. So this declaration was largely ignored by the powers, so Iranians were back to square one. So after this episode, the Iranian government's attempts to put an end to capitulations again took two forms, one international, one domestic. When the war ended, Iran sent a delegation to the Paris Peace Conference to try to extract reparations for the devastation caused by the presence of Central Powers and allied forces in Iran, neutral territory. And this delegation also requested the abolition of the capitulations, and in return it promised judicial reform. You know, we are happy to reform, and you have to take back the capitulations. But the British prevented Persia's participation in Versailles, arguing that this was a conference of the participants in the war, and since Iran had been neutral, it had no business participating in the conference. They even tried to force the 1919 agreement on Iran, very well known, which would have not abolished Iran's sovereignty, but put great limitations on it. But as we know, this attempt failed. Now, while the Iranian delegation was never able to participate officially at the Versailles conference, the diplomats, led by the extraordinary Firuz Mirza Nosratu-Doleh, one of the great statesmen of 20th century Iran, developed a frantic behind-the-scenes activity, trying to play the Americans, the British, and the French out against each other. They achieved two things. In September 1919, Lord Curzon, then acting foreign secretary, made a speech at London's Guildhall in honor of Firuz, in which he officially renounced the Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907, causing, this is ironic, protests on the part of the Russian diplomats present. Who were these Russian diplomats? Representatives of Admiral Kolchak's anti-Bolshevik counter-government in Omsk. It didn't amount to much. In Paris, this was in London, in Paris, the Iranians were able to get the League of Nations to issue an invitation to Iran to join, the only such invitation ever extended. Who joins the League of Nations? Only sovereign countries. So at a time when, in fact, the government in Tehran didn't have any authority in many, many parts of the country, because there were lots of peripheral rebellions, discursively, Iranian sovereignty was affirmed both by Lord Curzon and by the League of Nations, which was a masterful stroke of diplomatic prowess. But this wasn't all. In 1920, Iran and China concluded a treaty in which they recognized each other as equals. China was exactly in the same situation as in Iran. They also wanted to get rid of the capitulations. So even though exchanges between Iran and China were perhaps not that intensive, the two had an interest in forging this alliance in which they hoped to use as a precedent for equal relations with other countries. Subsequently, Iran signed more treaties on the basis of equality, always omitting the most favored nation clause, This was a deliberate move, as I said, to create precedents for putting the country's relations with the major powers on a new equal footing. In February 1921, Iran finally officially recognized the communist regime in Russia and signed a treaty with it. The first article of this treaty gave substance to the Bolsheviks' declarations of 1917 and 1918. I read it for you, it's interesting. Article 1. The RSFSR formally affirms once again, that it definitely renounces the tyrannical policy carried out by the colonizing governments of Russia, which have been overthrown by the will of the workers and peasants of Russia. Desiring that the Persian people, it's interesting, in Russia we have workers and peasants, in Iran we have peoples. This is Lenin's alliance with nations, right? Desiring that the Persian people shall be happy and independent and shall be able to dispose fully of its patrimony, the Russian Republic declares the whole body of the treaties and conventions with Persia by the Tsarist government, which crushed the rights of the Persian people, to be null and void. This is a treaty now. So much for the external environment. Now let's turn to developments within Iran. Given the breakdown, almost, of state authority in the country, the capitulatory powers became more daring. Ahmad Matin Daftari, a foreign ministry official in charge of relations with Russian subjects and a protege and later son-in-law of Mohammad Mossadegh, remembers as follows. I read from his writings. All sorts of, this is a man who, inside the foreign ministry in Tehran, has to deal with all these protégés and the Russians and so on. He feels this inequality, in his bones, if you like. He writes, all sorts of people came to see us, not only the rich and noble, but also people from the lower classes, including grocers, butchers, and farmers, all subjects or protégés of Russia. The Russian employees of the Russian legation did not deign visit us. And if they had to contact us, the head of our office would go to their legation. Elsewhere, he writes, under whatever pretext the Russian legation allowed itself to present as Russian protégés, Persian citizens whose birth and familial ties left no shadow of a doubt about their Persian origin. These protected persons, enjoying consular jurisdiction, to the detriment of their compatriots, would become docile slaves of Russian diplomacy. In their capacity as merchants or large landowners, they could exercise great influence in the country in favor of their masters. Gradually, every malevolent Persian who wanted to oppress his neighbor, kill an opponent with impunity, usurp the inheritance of a minor, refuse to pay his taxes, had only to add an off to, in the Russian manner, to his Persian name, for instance, Aliyov, to solicit Russian protection. Killing an opponent with impunity, usurping the inheritance of a minor, refusing to pay taxes, clearly what was needed was a state of law, a Rechtsstaat, to prevent all of these things. In the years since the Constitutional Revolution, a number of legal reforms had been enacted and a court system had been set up, but their actual implementation left a lot to be desired. I will not go into detail. Hadi Inayat has written a wonderful book about this issue. The inadequacy of what had been created after the Constitutional Revolution can be seen in the diary of one of the most remarkable diarists of Iranian history, Prince Eino Saltaneh, who was a nephew of Nasiruddin Shah and who kept a diary for about 70 years. He was a nephew of Nasiruddin Shah and a cousin of Mossadegh's mother. And he wrote in his diary, quote, at the present time, as our overbearing and impudent lawyers, who, in spite of engaging in bribery and using 1,000 tricks, cannot bring a single case to a close, it is difficult to believe that an Armenian or European who wishes honestly to state his case could get a fair trial. that Eino Saltaneh should single out Armenians and Europeans for not being able to get a fair trial shows two things. One, of course, is a discrimination against non-Muslims, Armenians. And the second one is that even this new post-constitutional revolution legal system did not ensure the equality of all, irrespective of religion. This became apparent in 1923 when Mossadegh was briefly foreign minister. A number of ulema started opposing a penal code, a provisional penal code that had been set up in 1917, and they actually obtained its abrogation. So Iran had no modern penal code. Back to, you know, Esas and all of that. The new Soviet envoy, Shumyatsky, wrote a letter to Mossadegh asking him which law the Iranian government would apply to Soviet citizens. You know, we have renounced our capitulations. Okay, we don't want them. You don't want them either. So under what laws will our citizens be tried? Mossadegh didn't know what to do, and so he forwarded this letter to the Ministry of Justice, which responded to Mossadegh that Iran at one point had had pertinent laws, but these had been abrogated under pressure from the ulema. Such an answer, of course, could not be forwarded to the Soviet embassy, and so Shumyatsky never received an answer to his question. And this was, of course, a highly embarrassing situation when a country has to admit that it has no laws. Mossadegh had named Ahmad Matin Daftari to be his chief of staff, and the two were repeatedly approached by consuls of foreign countries who worried about the legal status of their citizens in Iran. And given this pressure, Mossadegh persuaded the prime minister to ask parliament to entrust the government with the task of enacting a penal code while parliament was in recess. So public opinion would have no influence on what this penal code entailed. In the meantime, it was decided that Mossadegh would speak to a number of the ulema to prevent them from sabotaging this code again. Damishunu bebine. He began by visiting one Hajar Jamal, who had been relatively sympathetic to the constitutional movement and who was an old acquaintance, hoping that if he made any headway with him, he could then approach other ulema. He told Jamal that the law was not meant for Muslims and that its only purpose was to ensure that the crimes of foreigners not remained unpunished. Jamal very quickly saw through this fib and objected that if it were enacted by parliament, it would soon become applicable to Muslims as well. He was, of course, right about that. Mossadegh pleaded that if the law were not passed, Soviet citizens could not be prosecuted for any crimes, leaving the capitulations in place. To this argument, Jamal's short and pithy answer was Jahannam, which in a polite translation becomes so be it. Mossadegh concluded that there was no point in pursuing the matter with other ulema. Sometime later, a preacher said in a rosé, a religious gathering, that a cabinet in which Mossadegh Saltaneh was foreign minister could not defend Iran against infidels. A charge that Mossadegh tells us was soon repeated wherever people gathered in Tehran. At this point, the reformers, who now had the support of Iran's emerging strongman Reza Pahlavi, decided to institute reforms, whether the clerics liked them or not. And more codes were translated from European languages. Young Iranians were sent abroad to study European legal systems, and gradually a new legal system with a court system and so on was created in Iran. The new penal code was an adaptation of the French Code Penal of 1810, although its Article 1 paid lip service to the Sharia. It's an article that actually means absolutely nothing when you read it. By contrast, the new civil code, which was regarded as the mother of all laws, while borrowing procedures from European law, codified elements of 12 Shi'i law, most notably in private law, you know, inheritance, marriage, divorce, and so on, thus overcoming clerical misgivings. So one should not think that the clerics were totally excluded from this, from the creation of this legal system. The civil code bore their influence. The task of giving Iran a modern legal system was accomplished in record time. On February 9th, 1926, the old judiciary created in 1911 was dissolved. To underscore Iran's compliance with international norms, in the same year of 1926, Iran signed the convention to suppress the slave trade and slavery created under the League of, under the League's auspices. When the judiciary was introduced to Reza Shah in April 1927, on that very occasion, he ordered the government to prepare for the abolition of the capitulations. On May 10th, 1927, the government sent notes to foreign governments informing them that Iran would withdraw from all unequal treaties by May 10th, 1928. As a member of the League of Nations now, Iran was able to justify its desire to abolish the capitulations by referring to Article 19 of the Covenant, which said, quote, "The Assembly may from time to time advise the reconsideration by members of the League of treaties which have become inapplicable." This was a justification for this abolition. During this 1 year, from the announcement to the actual date, the government adroitly used international law to unburden itself of its obligations. Where bilateral treaties contained withdrawal clauses, these were activated. And where not, the government denounced them unilaterally, invoking Article 19 of the Covenant. After some mild resistance, all former capitulatory powers relented, and on May 10th, 1928, Iran achieved legal parity with other nations. Slavery was abolished in 1929 as the final measure. So, unlike China's famous century of humiliation, Iran's century of humiliation actually lasted 100 years, from 1828 to 1928. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hushang. Khaste nabashid.
Teshne nabashid.
Teshne nabashid. Would you like to, I think it might be better if we sit there.
Okay.
That way you can rest a little bit as well. And then we can take some questions. Okay, so in this very, very modern lecture theater, you'll see that there are microphones in front of you. So if you want, when you ask your question, please just press the button on the microphone and it will turn on. And that way we can all hear you and we can also record what's being said. So please, any questions? You have stunned them into silence for sharing.
Have I bored you to tears?
Yes, please, this gentleman here.
Very much for the wonderful presentation, Khushalabi. I noticed that during that 100 years of history, the emphasis for the struggle to gain sovereignty, the big push was from 1906 onwards against a period of extreme pressure by first Russians and the British. And what I wanted to ask you is that on the basis of history repeating itself, and as we have been continuing to get more and more sovereignty for the next 7 or 8 decades, do you think that the history will repeat itself, and we really have to start struggling for sovereignty?
What I talked about was political sovereignty. There's obviously the other issue, which is economic sovereignty. And that is a major topic that I'm not qualified to talk about. And even if I were, I doubt you wanted another hour. So I left that out of my talk completely. But I think by the 1960s and 1970s, Iran had gained its economic sovereignty as well. And, you know, at this point, I think Iran is a fully sovereign state. It pursues an independent foreign policy. And so foreign policy one may dislike, but the fact is that it's made in Tehran. And so I don't think there's anything in history to be repeated.
Please. Do I have to hold it down? You have to hold it down. Fantastic, very interesting talk. Thank you so much for that. In the early period of your talk, you focused, and you said Iran focused on rule of law, and that rule of law, if they established a rule of law, that that would somehow create the conditions for greater sovereignty. Can you just expand a little bit on the reasons why they took that view? Because that the basis of the power of the French and the English and so on was first economic development and then it was military power, one could argue. So it'd be interesting to get your thoughts
on that. Well, the first reforms enacted in Iran were actually military reforms, because Iran had lost wars with Russia. And so the first response was, everything is fine. We have a great culture, an ancient civilization. We are the most sophisticated people in the world. But we don't have military power. So let's reform the army. And the result is the Nizam-e-Jadid of Abbas Mirza and so on. Except that there wasn't enough money to follow up on that. And with all the attempts to reform the military, Iran was still losing territories to the Russians, this time in the northeast of the country, Marv and so on. And so it became clear that military reform alone isn't enough. You need to develop the country. But to develop a country, you need a legal system that, for instance, guarantees property rules. Contracts, and so on. So the idea is that unless you have a state of law where the provincial governor doesn't exploit the people, where, I mean, how was Iran governed? People bid for governorships, and the person who promised the central government the most amount of money, if you were governor of Hamadan, would get the job, which means that he would go to Hamadan and exploit the people as much as he could so that he could keep something for himself and get the rest to the government. This actually was the case even for diplomats. I mean, diplomats that were stationed abroad didn't receive any money, and they were told to issue passports and visas and get their income this way. And for instance, there is a case of somebody stationed, I can't remember where, in Tbilisi, who issued so many passports and so many visas and gave Iranian citizenships to so many people. Why would anybody want Iranian citizenship? Because that gave you extraterritoriality in the Ottoman Empire, right? Given the So he issued so many passports and visas that he built a gigantic mansion for himself in Tbilisi, which is still there. So, you know, when you have such a system of corruption, it's very difficult to develop the country economically. And so the idea was that despotism had to end,
And despotism meant equality before the law, from the Shah and the governors of the provinces, all the way down to the people. And that's why law became so important.
Oh, thank you for what I learned from that lecture. Persia had been a member of the League. It also occurred to me that India was a member of the League, as was Egypt quite late in its history, and some places that were sort of pseudo-client states like Cuba. So is there a danger of attributing too much historical importance?
Yeah. Good question. India, of course, we know why India became a member of the League, because Britain called the shots. And made sure that it had two seats at the League, India and Britain. Cuba was under the heavy influence of the United States, but at that point it was a sovereign country. Egypt became a Egypt and Iraq, actually. Iraq became a member of the League only in the mid-1930s, when it became nominally sovereign. So with the exception of India, all the countries of the, all the members of the League of Nations were actually formally sovereign states.
Yes, please.
Thank you for your informative presentation. It seems there is a gap between the perception of sovereignty among diplomats and the public perception of sovereignty. And this gap, usually mobilized by ulema during tobacco protests or economic concessions, and lead to, and we can see it in the oil nationalization movement. Do you think this gap between public perception of sovereignty compared to perception of sovereignty among diplomats and politicians had contribution to weakening the sovereign political sovereignty during these days?
Well, I don't think the diplomats overestimated the degree of latitude that Iran had in international relations. They knew full well what constraints they were working under, except they were realistic enough to try to make the best out of an unfavorable situation. They were realistic. And so I think it's a, you know, this take this expression semi-colonial. I mean, countries like Thailand, Iran, and Ethiopia are very often called semi-colonial. Well, semi, yes, but semi means half. What about the other half? My talk was about the other half, right? So any country that is semi-colonial is by the same token semi-sovereign. So what did they do with the limited sovereignty they had? This is my research, because I think you need a complete, you don't get a full picture if you only focus on the empty half of the glass. You also have to look at the full half of the glass. And I think public opinion in Iran, perhaps understandably, given the national pride in Iran, has tended to be more indignant about the empty half than grateful for the full half. And so this, I think, is a, you know, it's a constant.
Yeah. Right. Hello. Thank you for the lecture. I was wondering if any of the semi-sovereign tribes within Iran, like the Bakhtiaris and others, tried to undermine this sort of performative sovereignty that the Persian state was trying to project abroad?
I don't think they tried to undermine it. I think I don't think undermining the sovereignty was the motivation. They were trying to safeguard their own interests. And if that entailed undermining the central government, so be it. Basically, Iran in the 19th century was not a nation state. There were many parts of the country where local rulers held sway, and these local rulers were formalistically appointed by the central government, but they were actually dynasties. I mean, the last four of them were abolished by Reza Shah, the Khan of Maku, the Amir of Qainat, Khan of Elam, I think was the name, and then, of course, Mahamara, the principality of Mahamara, later Khurram Shah. So it's very often sort of argued that foreigners come in and deal with these people autonomously to undermine the central government. No, I mean, the British came in and dealt with the Bakhtiaris because they wanted order in the Bakhtiari areas. So if the Iranian government can't provide that and you want order, what do? You deal with the people who can actually provide that order, which is the Bakhtiari clans, tribes. So I think this notion that a foreign policy of a country is centralized in the foreign ministry of that country presupposes a central government that has actually control over the entire territory. If you don't have that central government authority over the entire territory, those people who have the actual control in some parts will have autonomous dealings with outside powers. So, yes, when they saw that, the Bakhtiaris were very patriotic in 1906, 1907, it's Bakhtiari troops who defeated the absolutism of Muhammad Ali Shah. In other cases, they may have had a different view of what their interests was. Yeah, thank you.
Yes, please, in the back.
Thank you for delivering such an engaging lecture. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I was just curious as to why you ended Iran's century of humiliation, as you described it, in 1928. Because to me, it seems as though these capitulations continued in certain cases, for instance, with the British workers in Abadan, and also with members of Amishmag from the United States in the 1970s. And both of those were very big political issues at their time in Iran. So I was just wondering why you see these potentially as being distinct from earlier capitulations, or what your reasoning was on that.
The reasoning is, first of all, I talked about, as I mentioned previously, I deliberately set aside the economic aspect. I mean, Abadan was a colonial enclave. We know that. But this gets us into more economic issues. And in fact, Reza Shah tore up the oil agreement in 1934 in order to go beyond 1928. But he wasn't strong enough. I mean, the British were able to twist his arm. As for the exemption from Iranian jurisdiction of, for instance, the Point 4, Americans, or later on in 1964, the SOFA agreement with the United States, it was much more focused. They were much more focused. I mean, when Iran granted extraterritorial rights to American military personnel, as per the SOFA of 1964, this was a particular category of people. It was sort of, it was more, you could also say that, well, diplomats have diplomatic immunity. Does that mean a capitulation? No. It was just that what applied to diplomats was extended to a larger group of people. But the average American in Iran very much came under Iranian law. And besides, the 1964 SOFA was not at all unique. America has SOFAs with many countries in the world, including Japan, for instance, which is a much more powerful nation than Iran. In the 1960s and 1970s, it was a much more powerful nation than Iran. America has two dozen bases on the island of Okinawa, even today, and those Americans enjoy extraterritorial rights in Japan. If an American in Okinawa commits a crime, he is immediately shipped to the United States, much to the regret of the Japanese, of course. So the issue of exemptions from local jurisdiction for American troops abroad is one that is not unique to Iran.
Thank you so much for your talk. It was really interesting. I was just wondering if you were able to tell us a little bit about, so your talk went up to 1928. So once Iran was established as a sovereign nation, how, I guess, how easy was it or how hard was it for them to get sort of buy-in from the wider public in Iran? And how easy or difficult was it to then enforce all these laws that they now had?
Yeah, there's a very interesting case because there was a litmus test. In 1932, so we're only 3 or 4 years, right? The modern system is beginning to work. We have courts, we have judges. The judges have nice black gowns, and everything is hunky-dory. And a German banker who worked for the Iranian banking system commits fraud. And what do we do? And the Iranian government wanted to make sure that he gets a fair trial in Iran. And this became a very important case. They made sure that he had a lawyer from Germany to represent him. They made sure that the judges who looked over his case had a knowledge of German. And they condemned him because he was guilty. But they say that perhaps if he had been in Germany, he would have got a stiffer punishment. And so everything went well. I mean, they proved in practice that the system worked. And so the, you know, I've talked to a number of lawyers, Iranian lawyers, who were not necessarily favorable to the pre-1979 regime, but they tell me that on the whole, the legal system in Iran worked rather well. There was, for instance, even though the death penalty was on the books, judges tried very hard to avoid handing out a death penalty. And there were relatively few death penalties handed out. And when one was handed out, like, for instance, the famous one of Asghar Qatel, the mass murderer, it became a big event. So on the whole, Darvaz reforms were, I think, were quite successful.
Firstly, thank you very much for your talk. It was really enjoyable. I was wondering, what role do you think this century played in the national psyche, like it did in China, for example? Or would you argue that the main distrust of the West came from 1953 instead?
Good question. I think the West itself is a construct because there was always distrust of the British, but there was much less distrust of the French and the Germans. So, or the Belgians for that matter, even though the Belgians didn't make themselves popular in the Constitutional Revolution. But America was quite popular until the 1950s. So I think to lump all Western countries together as the evil West is a phenomenon of the early 60s with Gharb Zadegi and all of that.
Any other questions? Please, Ellie, yes.
One of the themes running through your, or threads running through your talk was the powerlessness of the central government and the Shahs during this period in terms of breaking the yoke of the control that the imperial powers had. Do you think there is anything more they could have done? Is there anything they could have done differently? Were there any major strategic errors, for example, tactical errors they made that prolonged the period of semi-colonialism.
I'm beginning to think that while they upheld Iranian sovereignty at the end of the day, if I compare Iran with Thailand, for instance, Thailand did much better. Thailand was exactly in the same situation as Iran. The British Empire in the west with Burma and in the south with Malaya, and the French Empire to the east with Indochina. But Thai reforms were done in a much more rational and consequential way than in Iran. I think Nasruddin Shah in particular may have liked dressing up as a European and sort of, you know, enjoyed hobnobbing with European royalty. But deep down, you know, he remained a despot and stymied reform. And that's why all the reform attempts that we have, Amir Kabir, Mirza Hasan Khan, and so on, ultimately petered out. So I think there really wasn't enough will. And there's a fantastic book written by the Etemadu Sultani that I quoted at the very beginning, which was written for the, I think, for the 40th anniversary of Nasruddin Shah's rule, and which lists all the innovations and modern things that had come in. Well, what does this list contain? One is, for instance, the introduction of umbrellas. The other one is the fact that European bread was now available in Iran. And so very superficial things. There's nothing there about a court system, rationalizing the law, and so on. So, in fact, the reformers in Iran who talked about these things, if they were against the regime, they had no influence at all. And if they tried to work within the regime, like Amir Kabir and the others, they were marginalized.
Any other questions? This might be your last opportunity. So don't miss out. One last one. Yes, please.
Well, the logic of federalism is very different from the logic of empire. The logic of empire is that different parts of the state have a different status. Some are ruled directly by the capital, others are ruled by governors, and yet others are ruled by local dynasties who pay lip service to the central government. I mean, if you look at the British Empire, even in India, different parts of India had different constitutional statuses regarding London, indirect rule, direct rule, etc. Federalism presupposes the equality of all units. I mean, Bavaria and North Rhine-Westphalia have the same rights and duties within the German Federation. And there are people in Iran who have talked about federalism, particularly of the Indian kind, because in India, the federal states are based on ethnicity and language. And so many people think that to solve the multilingual problem in Iran, the fact that Iran has different ethnic groups, federalism is the answer, with a Kurdish state, a Turkmen state, a Baluch state, and so on. And it has worked in India, by and large, except in Kashmir, but I'm not sure it would work in Iran. So I don't really see any parallels between the Iranian logic, which is the logic of empire, an empire that has to be turned into a nation state, and the logic of countries like Germany or the United States, which is based on the coming together of equals, legal equals. I mean, Bremen and Bavaria are not equals in economic terms, but they're legally the same.
Wonderful. Well, we definitely gave you a good intellectual workout at the LSE, Huzheng.
Very good. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much, really. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you all for coming. I like to think that Dr. Nick Pei would be proud of us, and we did it. We did him. We fulfilled our obligation towards him. We hope to see you next year for the next Ghulam Reza Nick Pei annual lecture. So please do stay in touch with the Department of International History, look forward to seeing you back here in a year's time. But before you go, please join me in thanking Huzheng Shahabi for a wonderful evening.
Yes.